You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job. At the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Vikram Mansuramani. Dr. Mansuramani is a global trend watcher who shows people how to anticipate the future, manage risk, and spot opportunities. He is currently a lecturer at Harvard University, where he teaches students to use multiple perspectives in making tough decisions. Previously, he was a lecturer at Yale University. In addition to teaching, he also advises several Fortune 500 CEOs to help them navigate the radical uncertainty in today's business and regulatory environment. He has a PhD and two master's degrees from MIT and a bachelor's degree from Yale University. He has a new book. It's called Think for Yourself, Restoring Common Sense in an Age of Experts and Artificial Intelligence. Vikram, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we're starting our podcasts since the global pandemic started as a check-in. So I'm in my home on the northwest side of Chicago, and we're okay, we're safe, we're healthy. I trust you are the same.
I am indeed. I'm at my home in Lexington, Massachusetts, safe and healthy.
Okay, great. In the introduction of your new book, you write, quote, "You may not realize it, but you've lost your mind. We all have," end quote. Now, this is a statement I can deeply relate to in this time and place, but tell us what you meant when you used those words to start the book. Oh, I imagine you were writing this a long while ago.
Yeah, so what I meant by it was we've learned to effectively outsource our thinking. It's sort of this learned dependency, if you will, on the thinking process employed by, and I suggest it's not just people, i.e. in the form of experts, but also technologies and protocols and rules. We literally have stopped thinking in times where we just blindly follow the guidance given to us. And I think that's one way to interpret the problem of losing our minds, that we've effectively let others take over our thinking. But the other thing that happened is sometimes we refuse to listen to experts and those who know better than we do. And that is equally problematic. And so, you know, restoring our mind, if you want to use that language, involves thinking for ourselves.
You even cite Philip Tetlock's work at Penn, which found that experts are actually less accurate predictors than non-experts in their area of expertise.
That's right. Yeah.
It seems piece of research. Wild.
It's awesome. I mean, I will tell anyone who's listening, reading Philip Tetlock's work is one of the more influential things that I've done in my thinking process. And it really does stem from this idea that specialists tend to be narrow and focused. And they're like men running, or women running around with hammers. And so, surprise, surprise, they see some nails. Yeah. And the generalist, i.e. one who is not specialized in that deep, narrow sense, may be someone that has multiple tools in their toolbox. They may have a screwdriver, they may have a wrench, as well as that hammer. And so when they see the little narrow silver shaft with a flat top on it, they may say, oh, I'm not just going to hit it. I'm going to look and see if it has a slit on that top. I'm going to look and see if the top round is actually not round, but is a hexagon or an octagon. It may require a wrench. I'm going to look and see if it's threaded. And so the mere act of not being narrowly specialized allows you to see the world slightly differently. And I think it's that different perspective or those multiple perspectives that helps us navigate uncertainty. And that's what I think Tetlock's work, as well as others' works, have found.
So you introduce us to Thomas Young, who you write is the last person to know everything.
Not my description.
Someone else's.
The description of Andrew Young, who I think, Robinson, who wrote the biography of Thomas Young as the last man who knew everything. But even the interesting thing is that was hundreds of years ago in the UK, where this amazing individual was able to contribute to ophthalmology, particle and wave theories of light. He was a practicing physician, etc. But even then, there was obviously some tension in being broad because he hid the fact that he was contributing so widely to numerous fields from his patients in his medical practice. Uh-huh. And the reason he did was that his patients wanted him focused on the human being, on that body. And sort of being a medical doctor even then was thought to be something you narrowly specialize in. And I think there's value in seeing the context, connecting dots, not just generating dots. And so, but yes, I do highlight him as perhaps the last man who knew everything.
And you know, it's especially a problem now because there's too much information. I had this conversation with my doctor about how many papers you have to read to stay on top of the field. And it's like thousands every week. It's impossible.
That's right. It's absolutely impossible. In fact, I start off the logic of my thesis really starts with we're drowning in data. We're drowning in information. It's overwhelming. And we're also drowning in choices. And this is the interesting part that I think connects the dots towards a bigger statement I'm trying to make, which is that's fine. We all know we're drowning in data, information, and choices. But the problem is it offers this potential, this elusive goal of an ideal choice, a perfect decision, a maximized outcome. And it's that optimization process that leaves us with this low-grade anxiety. And we're always suffering from this fear of missing out on the optimal best choice. And that is what leads us running headlong into the arms of experts, technologies. And so we're happy to stop thinking if someone can solve this problem and give us the best choice, the optimal decision. That is worth giving up our thinking for, or so we have come to believe.
And then add in the social media. And you I mean, it becomes... and it's not just the, what I thought was interesting about your discussion of social media, it's not just the obvious points. You write in the book, quote, social media presents an image of the world as being far more positive than reality. And they're like, oh, that's a kind of an interesting nuanced thing that maybe someone's looking at like, oh, my life should be like that, when we all know everyone lies on Facebook.
No, that's right. So think about the last time you posted something really negative about your life. Think about the last time. I mean, I asked some of my friends, I was like, so you lost your job. You're putting that up on Facebook? No, I don't really like advertising that. Okay, so right off the bat, we know that people who lost their job that jump on to social media see a worldview that shows fewer people losing their jobs than are actually losing their jobs. Yeah. And so therefore, it's natural. You develop anxiety and you can get some, you know, I think it exacerbates mental health issues and creates depression in people that come to believe that the perception they are getting from social media is not biased, when in reality, we know it is biased.
And I think you point out in the book, like, it's actually endangering our lives. Like, this selfie stuff is crazy.
Yeah, well, I actually use the sort of the desire that social media creates, which is a focus on appearances rather than experiences. It's all about documenting the selfie, so to say. In fact, there was a Wall Street Journal article that I referenced, which said, you know, please like my picture on Instagram. I hired a professional to help me take it. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of examples where people are trying desperately to get the absolute most extreme, coolest selfie shot. I think there's one example I reference in the book where someone scored what they thought was the absolute best, most amazing selfie. They got a selfie with the hijacker of a plane that they were on. I was like, what? This is like what you seek? What about safety? What about getting a No, I got the selfie. It was amazing, right? Whoa, what are we thinking about? What's the important part? And so, you know, in some sense, we're letting the tail wag the dog.
I don't want to make the podcast about me, but I'm going to for a second, and you'll see where I'm going with this. So I got diagnosed with a heart condition about a year and a half ago, and everything's fine, relatively speaking, but, you know, I got to keep my eye on it. And I just went and got my labs, that was like 3 weeks ago. And so that was an interesting process of having to pull up and get my temperature taken. And my cholesterol is a little high.
Uh-oh.
Everything else looks good.
Yeah. I know where you're going.
I come to this part in your book, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. So yeah. explain. So this is a thing that happens quite often. And by the way, my cardiologist wants, I got to go get a CT scan of my heart in August. So he's not rushing me, but it's definitely they're looking at it. But why might I be concerned about that?
Sure. So, you know, one of the examples that I've highlighted and talked about is the problem of siloization. So what happens is in this world where we start outsourcing our thinking to experts, we're outsourcing our thinking to those that live in narrow silos. By definition, someone who's narrow and deep is not looking broad and wide, right? As a result, they have their perspective and their area of focus and their area of concern. Your cardiologist is an example of one. And so the cardiologist likes to look at heart health, and heart health is the primary focus of the cardiologist. The same way a gastroenterologist looks at, you know, the different body parts, look at, you know, neurologist looks at the brain, et cetera. And so that's all fine and is helpful because it helps us understand and develop greater knowledge and greater depth of understanding of these parts. But sometimes what we lose is the connection between the parts. And so the example I discuss is, you know, it's actually with cholesterol and someone who develops high cholesterol, and their cardiologist says, you know, I really think you should be on a statin. And getting on a statin will help lower cholesterol. And we have great research, really do, Kelly. Number one, high cholesterol is associated with higher risk of heart attacks. We know that pretty close to certain. I mean, nothing is certain, but pretty close to certain. Secondly, we also know that lowering your cholesterol, taking a statin does in fact lower your cholesterol. That's pretty good. That's the reason why Pfizer's Lipitor was a multi-billion dollar drug. It works. It lowers your cholesterol. And so your cardiologist tells you, take this statin, your cholesterol will be lowered, and everything's great. So you go ahead, you do that next year, your cholesterol's down, cardiologist claims victory. Yep. However, then you go down the hall of your medical practice and you go see your endocrinologist, who says, Kelly, I'm a little concerned, your blood sugar, your insulin levels, I'm not feeling good about, I think you're pre-diabetic. I think you're actually developing diabetes here, and I'm a little concerned because higher risk of diabetes comes with a higher risk of heart attacks. Now, it turns out that the way statins work is they interfere with an enzyme that's involved also in the production of insulin. And so taking a statin, while it wins and it's successful if you're looking at the heart from the cardiologist's perspective, it is not. In all cases, again, I'm using very big generalizations to illustrate the siloization problem. In all cases, it doesn't work for reducing risk of heart attacks. And then you have to ask yourself, why do we care about cholesterol? Why? If not because of its relationship with risk of heart attack. And so how you lower your cholesterol actually matters. And so this is the problem of siloization and experts being narrowly focused in a domain where the context requires some dot connecting, not just generating.
So I want to ask some questions, right, to my doctor, and I want to make sure they're thinking broadly. And I mean, it's interesting. I made the perhaps disastrous choice to listen to podcasts of people I don't agree with.
Well, that's good.
It is. It's good. But one of the things that drives me crazy with this one podcast host who's very popular in particular is he claims expertise over every domain. So it is like how are you an expert in all these different areas? Because I don't think you are. And he was talking about police reform and taking a very sort of counter issue and then picking and choosing through the data. And that's a different problem altogether. But I like how you phrase this in the book. You say, quote, we're so busy digging through a haystack searching that we're not asking if we're even in the right barn.
That's right.
And you have a great bark metaphor for the same thing, right? Which is
I do that we've gotten so detailed in our study of bark. We look at the nooks, the crannies, et cetera, and sort of say, and the coloration and the moisture levels, et cetera, of the bark. We don't realize we're looking at a tree, and we sure as heck don't realize we're in a forest.
Yeah. So you also cite the Fukushima disaster. And I want you to talk about that because that's one of the, there's some parallel studies on improvisation in crisis management. And this being an example of seeing where someone was improvising incredibly successfully while others were not.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. Basically what you find in that example is the Japanese culture is so conformist oriented. It is so hierarchical. It is organized in a top down, you do kind of format. Mm-hmm. Questioning authority is not part of the protocol. And so when you are stuck in a crisis situation, you know, the normal course activity in Japan is to wait for the higher ups to tell you what to do.
Yep.
Follow the protocol until the higher ups tell you to do something different. And if you can't reach them or you're not sure, then, you know, what do? You stick with whatever you were supposed to be doing that you thought was normal course. Well, obviously, during the Fukushima disaster, we had a crisis on the hands of these nuclear power facilities. And I profiled one of the leaders there who decided to think for himself and actually decided like, okay, and, you know, there's a couple of different nuances in the story. I don't want to get lost in this rabbit hole, but, you know, flooding seawater into the reactor effectively destroys it, right? It's a multi-billion dollar reactor. Seawater on top of these rods, it creates all sorts of issues. And there's a really remote chance of something called recriticality, which is actually the opposite thing happens. You put seawater in there and it basically accelerates rather than dampens the nuclear reactions. It's a very remote thing. It has happened. And somewhere in this Japanese crisis, as it was unfolding, someone thought maybe that was a risk, so we shouldn't do it. And so the manager at the plant basically said, you know what, I'm going to think for myself and I'm going to do it, did it, and probably saved hundreds of thousands of lives is my guess, or for sure the evacuation of millions of people were prevented. And it required breaking with cultural norms, with the sort of conformity logic, et cetera, and thinking for yourself. So yeah, there's a lot of overlap with improvisation there.
And that person, of course, was lauded as a hero, I'm sure.
Unfortunately not. Unfortunately, no. He was, you would have thought, in fact, I think I say in the book that you would expect a person like this to be put on a pedestal, given all sorts of awards. Instead, he was reprimanded.
Yeah.
Which is a little disappointing. But later, you know, the official investigation into the report sort of, I would argue, in some ways vindicated his logic.
It's interesting. The last couple of weeks, this has come up a number of times, not just in the books I'm reading, though in those, but also in my conversations with my academic friends, is centering around this idea of intellectual humility.
Yes.
That this is an area that is highly deserving of study and attention right now.
Yeah. I think it has to do with this idea of, you know, men running around with hammers. So the more the intellectual progress has historically been valued more and more by being, you know, the more valued it is because it's deeper. It's, you know, it's cutting edge. I don't know any generalist who is valued for their intellectual contributions. Right. And you're sort of dabbling here, dabbling there, but you're dot connecting. And as a result, I would argue that generalists more often than not are more humble. It's because they know there's someone else who knows more about this than I do. Of course there is, because I'm spread. That person's just in that domain. And so, you know, I think being a generalist or trying to adopt a broad perspective can actually help develop some of this intellectual humility that I think is so needed.
I had not, so I knew of the one twist on the broken windows story. So many people know that from Malcolm Gladwell's work. Malcolm Gladwell, who frustrates academics everywhere for his incredible storytelling that shirks the actual information. But this popular story, right, and I think Freakonomics might have picked it up too, is that the broken windows policy, which they thought was successful in New York, actually turned out to not be, but then also could be responsible for what was the thing, like abortion rate going down? Was that the...
Yeah. So look, yeah. What happened was people were trying to understand what happened with crime in the early 1990s, suddenly improving dramatically in major urban areas. And there were all sorts of explanations for why this was the case, right? And so, you know, sure enough, some folks in New York City said, well, you know, we've adopted this broken glass theory of policing. And so what we're doing is we're going to fix broken glasses, people who jump turnstiles to get into the subway. We're going to stop the little crimes, because if the environment is such that little crimes are caught and people are punished for them, they for sure are not going to try to have big crimes, because the culture and the fabric on which all of this is taking place is deemed important. And so big crime stop because we stop little crimes. That's sort of the very generic version of broken glass. But then, you know, the folks from Freakonomics came out and said, well, you know, it's interesting. That may be the case. But if you really look back, turns out, you know, Roe versus Wade, abortion was allowed 17, 18 years before. It turns out that, well, you know, not having unwanted children, actually unwanted children are generally neglected and they may contribute to crime. And so when you suddenly prevent unwanted children from entering the world, then sure enough, you have people who are more cared for and they have less crime. And then there was even yet another theory that showed up that I talk about, which was, someone said, well, that's all fine and dandy, but this all happens simultaneously everywhere around the world. And it happens to correlate with de-letting of gasoline. Hmm. And you're like, wait, what? And yeah, actually, if something happens that simultaneously everywhere, it might not be policies that account for it. Hmm. It may in fact be something like a molecule. And sure enough, leaded gasoline and lead in the air. Lead is associated with all sorts of issues, ADHD and all sorts of other issues in the form of behavioral problems that emerge. And that could also be correlated to crime. So I don't try to suggest I understand what causes crime or doesn't. Merely that multiple lenses and looking through all of these, my guess is all of them have some degree of truth to them. And so, you know, combining these perspectives will, I think, result in a more robust understanding of the problem than merely relying on one.
So I'm curious, you're a very degreed individual. At what point did this sort of thesis, how did you form this thesis over time? I mean, I doubt it was something that came to you earlier in your career.
No, actually, it's funny. I never liked being put in a box. Mm. And so as an undergrad, they told me, you know, you have to major in something with a discipline. And I was like, wait, no, I like these multidisciplinary subjects. So I majored in East Asian studies, where I studied Chinese history, culture, art, economics, politics, etc., as well as another multidisciplinary major called ethics, politics, and economics. Mm. And so I dabbled is what the criticism is. I like to say I got a degree in generalism, general education. Then I went to grad school, and you know, the reason I ended up going to MIT was I wanted to get a PhD in something that was by definition broad. I wanted to be a, you know, sounds like a contradiction in terms, but I wanted to be an expert in being a non-expert, right? Yeah. I wanted to be a broad thinker. And so MIT just happened to have a PhD in innovation. I don't think I would have gotten a PhD were it not for a topic as broad and as general as that. And so I got to study strategy, psychology, economics, politics, the whole nine yards. And so it so happens to be that I could package it up and become deep in this dot connecting exercise known as innovation. But otherwise, I doubt I would have ever pursued a PhD because the concept is contradictory to my logic, right? I mean, sort of narrow and deep. That's not who I am or what I want to be.
Interesting. Okay. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story, but a couple other things I wanted to pick from the book. You talk about tech setting your decision frames. And I think this is sort of a powerful idea that people need to understand in terms of how they might not be in charge of their own mind without knowing it.
Yeah. So what ends up happening, well, we could go back to even the social media example, right?
Yeah.
Where we suddenly get a perception of reality that we think exists, but really it's algorithms. And in some cases now, we now know there's malicious attempts through the use of bots and other social algorithm influencing efforts to change what we see and to change what we think. But, you know, there's a wonderful example I use towards the end of the book where I talk about how an Android device. So look, there's 2 billion Android devices on the planet, some ungodly number of them. And it turns out there's been people who have taken them, put them in boxes to see what signals come out of them. And they've pulled out the chips and all the network stuff and say, what other signals are these devices projecting? And it turns out they have like a barometric pressure gauge. So they can tell where you are. They can tell height-wise where you are. They can tell where your speed is. They can tell your location, obviously, because they triangulate that. But it means that it's not only, then, Kelly, that they know where you are. They can say, okay, your phone showed up at that Starbucks on the corner of these two streets at the same time with a phone number you've been talking to only during off hours when you're in the car, etc., but not during the workday and not when you're at home. And this person happened to be at the Starbucks at the same time. Then you got in the elevator. We can tell from the barometric pressure gauge that you went up to the 16th floor. Mm-hmm. There happens to be a family law office there. That family law office specializes in divorce and settlements. And so then you came back down. You met with that same person. Your phones were at the same location again. You went. There were lots of late night calls, etc. And by the way, the Amazon link sends you a do-it-yourself divorce packet.
That's terrible.
Now, is it your choice? Or is it, okay, maybe it's spurring it. It's sort of the easy process. But the point is that's sort of a disturbing example. But, all of this happens in very micro slivers. And that's part of the reason why I think Shoshana Zuboff wrote that book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which I think is so frightening, really, because technology is sort of controlling where we think and how we think. We pretend, we sort of get this false comfort that we're in control. And in some cases, we're just following the cheese as they move it through the maze.
It's interesting. We do work at the University of Chicago, and I work particularly with Richard Thaler, who wrote the book Nudge. And the ethics conversation around nudges is fascinating to me, and one that they don't take lightly. You know, this idea of and for most of my podcast listeners know this because I talk about it all the time. But you know, the idea in behavioral science that, of choice architecture, that you can sort of design ways that people will buy your products, or also for social good. You know, in terms of opting into insurance and things like that. So, I don't think when I first read about that, realize that there are sincere ethical issues when you start nudging people.
Oh my goodness. So many issues that come up with the nudging concept. I mean, there's obviously the paternalistic logic that sort of emerges. Mm-hmm. Hold on a sec. You know better than I do. Since when and why? But then on a mass level, you know, that may in fact be the case, that you want people to mm-hmm. default into certain scenarios or certain choices. It's really fraught. I mean, yeah. We don't have enough time to get into it.
No. It's interesting, though. All right, one more thing. Quote, research shows that Nobel laureates are much more likely to have engaged in arts and crafts than other scientists.
Yeah, I think it's the diversity of interests and the pursuit of endeavors that particularly have some creative component to it, where there aren't the rules and sort of the boxes to stay within. I think that helps, that creative instinct that comes from pursuit of those activities, the development of that almost muscular sense of creativity and imagination, I think enables progress in all domains. And so, surprise, surprise, someone who's really into music and the performing arts, or someone who's also into the creative arts in the sense of visual work they do, or even sometimes fiction writers, etc., mm-hmm. are able to contribute to sort of the nonfiction world, if you will, mm-hmm. A little more substantively than you thought. And at the highest levels, i.e. Nobel Prize winners, we're seeing that there's some evidence of that, that creative instinct is useful and additive in almost any activity.
So I talk to all kinds of academics across all kinds of disciplines, and this thing comes up all the time. This idea of the arts and why it's important. If you think about it too, I mean, the reason they were invented was a way for us to understand ourselves.
Yep.
A way to see what our mind might be thinking, and so it's very interesting that one might find a return to the arts as a way to reclaim our mind.
That's right. Well, it's interesting, and apologies, I'm going to just interject here. One of the things I do in the class I teach at Harvard, so I teach a class called Humanity and Its Challenges, and it's a systems thinking class taught at the engineering school. And one of the things I do is I require my students to read novels. Mm-hmm. And you know how disruptive this is? They're like, wait, but that's not true. And I'm like, Yeah, but that's the point. I'm trying to get you to think bigger, broader, wider. And I want you to understand the ethical implications of some of these decisions and that human scenario of the pros and cons that emerge. Really worth exploring.
All right. So we always end the podcast by asking our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. They actually don't get very far by saying yes. We have them say yes and they affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Yeah, I do. So I was happily employed, had just written my first book about financial bubbles and had just done a speaking engagement and, you know, it went well. And I did another one, it went well. And there were these two friends of mine at the gym I belong to. And both of these young women said, you know, Vikram, you need to quit your job and just do this. You're really good at this. You should pursue this. I was like, how will I make a living? And eventually I was like, yes, and I'll make it work. Sure enough, I pursued it. I ended up leaving, was unemployed, technically unemployed for some period of time and took a risk on myself and decided that I would improvise literally a career trajectory that went from traditional money management towards creative in the sense of writing and thinking and connecting dots and sharing them in a broad way rather than a deep way. I didn't go down an academic path. I said I'd be a lecturer rather than a true tenure track faculty member. So I sort of carved my own path, so to say.
I love it. The book is called Think for Yourself, Restoring Common Sense in an Age of Experts and Artificial Intelligence. Vikram Mancharamani, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, man.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive. From adulthood, no one survives.